Thanks for listening to Other People's Flowers. If you'd like to have your work featured in the program, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Pity Friends by David Calladine. Off in the west, the last light of the dying day was a wriggling shimmer above the flat sea. Green grass stretched right to the cliff edge. Wind, cold and bitter from the tireless Atlantic, cut across the exposed land. The grey stone house of my friends, the Ritters, stood 30 yards from the cliff, a couple of yellow lights offering some comfort in the gloom. Rose had been given the house in Ireland by the cliffs, as it was known, by a great aunt, she told me, a hapless spinster, who'd given it to her so she could focus on her art. She'd moved there with husband Michael almost 5 years ago now. We're escaping the London blur, they told me when they left. It's too much for artists like us. We're landscapists, and we need the solitude. We need the peace. And on that evening, as I stepped out of the taxi and heard it fading on the gravel behind me, nowhere seemed more remote or isolated. I clutched my bag against my shoulder, clicked open the faded wooden gate, and reached the front door. Rose was waiting for me when I got there. "Hello, hello, hello," she said, kissing me on both cheeks. "How was the journey? Michael's so excited to see you. We're both so excited to see you." I shivered as I entered, shaking off the last of the cool evening. An old bicycle, rusted and disused, leant against the hallway wall. Rose led me through the corridor into the kitchen and gestured for me to put my things down. "Michael's just in his studio," she said, putting the kettle on. "He'll be down any moment." "You made it here all right, then. What did you think of the journey? Beautiful coastal route. We're very lucky, really. It's so rare to see the Atlantic like we do." The walls were hung with paintings and drawings. Their work, I assumed. I hadn't seen their art in the years they'd been away. There had been a few exhibitions, at a rate of about 2 a year, but I'd never summoned the interest to go. Art had never much interested me. I was not the sort of person who bought paintings. "I'll make some tea." She fiddled around with her back to me, waiting for the kettle to boil, and fetching mugs from inside the cupboard. Looking at her, she looked older, aged even. Her hair was tied up in a bun, and the strands that fell freely were grey and twisted. From behind, she looked well over 32. Rose and I had had a brief, one-sided relationship before she and Michael began officially seeing each other. One-sided because I was convinced it was going somewhere, after a couple of dates and a single kiss, and all the while she'd been seeing someone else. Scientists, like myself, were not her type. "Hello, hello, hello." Wearing stained paint overalls, circle glasses, hands in pockets, skin whitened with turpentine, Michael greeted me from the door. We shook hands and he sat down at the table without greeting his wife. "So how are you? What do you think of our little abode? We'll give you a proper tour around later. I expect you just want to relax for a moment now, though. How was the journey? Excuse the paint, I've been hard at it all day. You know how it is when you're at the brink of finishing a piece of work. You just can't tear yourself away." "No, I don't. I've never painted." "Of course he's never painted," said Rose, sliding two cups of tea towards us. "He's fortunately never had to suffer creativity like we both have." I ignored the comment and sipped my tea. It was too milky. "It's a beautiful spot," I said. They both smiled. "It is. We're very lucky. It's so quiet here. Everything is so peaceful. We don't have a television, no internet, just us, books and our work." "Does it get lonely?" Rose looked at me sharply in response. "No," said Michael. "Of course not. We've got each other, after all." After my tea, I was shown my room and treated to a tour of the house. My bedroom was on the second floor in the library. They'd set up a camp bed for me, and the smell of old books greeted me as I dumped my suitcase on the floor. The bathroom was next door. At the end of the hallway was their bedroom, and the other room was a study, which neither of them ever used. What I was interested in was their studios, but they were reluctant to give me a tour. "Why do you want to see that?" asked Rose. "It's so boring." "It's just a room that smells of oil. Oil and white spirit," said Michael from behind. Their studios were upstairs on the third floor, and I was quickly led downstairs to the living room, a dull room with only two small windows and a rotting sofa and chair. I'm on dinner duty tonight, said Michael, so I'll let you two get comfortable. The drinks are in the cabinet. Help yourself to anything you want. I thanked him, and headed straight for the drinks cabinet. There was an enormous selection of alcohol. Gin, wine, bourbon, whiskey, rum, even apple sours. Rose asked for a glass of red wine and I joined her. I'll make a fire. She knelt and started scrunching paper up and bundling a pyramid of wood. She tossed in a couple of fire lighters. I handed her her wine and she reclined on the edge of the sofa next to me. It's really heaven here. There's just peace and quiet all the time. Can you hear that? That's the sea. Sometimes we just sit and listen to the sea. So beautiful. The sky makes such amazing patterns. The light's wonderful here. But I suppose you don't want to be bored with all those artistic details. How is life in London? It's good, I said, because for me it really was. I'm still working at the university. It's fun. I get a lot of satisfaction from it. What is it you research again? Maths, was it? Science. Science-y. I'm useless at science. I suppose some of us are artists, some of us are scientists. I'm really attached to the philosophy department. I teach logic. How do you find teaching? I find it so dull. I have to teach a couple of evening classes a week, and it really takes time away from my real work. It's mostly retired women, the occasional man, leching at the model. It's really tedious. So why do you do it? She let out a long sigh. Money, really. What else? It's always money, isn't it? I hate money sometimes. It holds us back so much, doesn't it? Ties us to places. Michael and I are very lucky that we don't have any dependents, that we can just leave whenever we want. I think we're freer than most people that way, but money still restricts us. I assume this meant her parents were no longer paying for her. In all the years she'd been in London, I could never remember her having a job, or actually making any money. I think she was a teacher for a while, but that too was too distracting for her. This sort of attitude was one of the reasons I sometimes felt disdain for my friends. Not everyone has the luxury of retiring to the Irish coast to paint. Most people have to stay behind and work. Most people have to face reality in all its bitter coldness. Dinner, or supper, as Rose insisted it be called, was a roast pheasant and potatoes. It was a little bland, but the two of them wolfed it down like they were starving. The kitchen was cold, draughts pushed through the single glazed windows, and I struggled to avoid shivering as we ate. The third bottle of wine was open, and I was already beginning to feel a little woozy. I'm very interested in electronics these days, said Michael. Rose, as you know, is much more of a traditional artist than I am. Paints, only paints. But I'm fascinated in the fusion between electronics and art. You're a scientist, Alistair. I imagine you could explain current and voltage and all that to me. Sadly, I'm a logician, I answered. I'm not really placed to talk about electricity. I'm not interested in electricity. I'm interested in electronics. I'm rigging up a printer to see if I can somehow transfer my creations onto the computer and print them off. But we don't have a computer, darling, said Rose. Yes, but I can buy one or borrow one from the college. Oh, the college, she said, pushing some brown meat into her mouth. The curse of our existence. I was telling Alistair about the college. It's a nightmare that we have to teach there, isn't it? All those people wanting to be artists, but none of them quite succeeding. None of them are willing to make the sacrifice that we've made. Give up life in London and go paint and do nothing else. That's the only way to be an artist. I was convinced that there were plenty of other ways to be an artist, and that giving it all up and moving to Ireland was probably a dream many people harboured, artists or not. I have to confess I quite enjoy my teaching, dear. I like some other human contact. It reminds me why we're here. Why are you here? I asked. To help mankind through great art, of course, he replied. Of course, chimed Rose. I assume this talk was a result of too much wine. After supper, we had a few more glasses and talked about old times. They both reminisced about London as if they were 50, not early 30s. Michael announced that he needed to work late that night, as he was on the cusp of creativity. He wouldn't see me in the morning, he said, as he always taught on a Saturday. Rose and I would go for a walk, and did I mind terribly if we all had an early night? So I was left to lie on the camp bed, reading a waxy copy of The Wind and the Willows, while I listened to Michael stamping around in his studio above me, and Rose fiddling around in the bathroom next door. Slowly, the Irish night closed in. Through my window, out at sea, I could make out the pale shapes of ships far off in the distance. Lights blaring. Wind shook the fragile glass, and I shivered until sleep came. With Michael off teaching, Rose insisted that the two of us go for a walk along the coast, despite the wind and drizzle. "It's good for your constitution," she said, as I finished my coffee. "Excellent for your complexion. How do you think I stay looking so young?" So we pulled on wellies, dragged large raincoats over ourselves and wrapped scarves around our necks before heading out into the cold air. "I can't believe it's the end of May," she said. "It feels like it could snow. If we go along the coast, I can show you some of the places that have inspired me. Or inspired us. Michael gets inspired a lot as well." A coastal path, gravelly and muddy, ran all along the sharp cliff edge. Theirs was the only house for miles along the coast. I wondered, looking back at the grey, stone, lonely building, why anyone would want to live in such an inhospitable place. Yes, it was beautiful, but all those gloomy seas and pallid skies would surely become depressing after a while. "So have you met anyone?"
"No."
"No one at all?"
"Not yet."
"But are you seeing someone?"
"I have been."
"What's she like? You should have brought her to meet us." My wellies squelched into a thick paste of mud as we rounded a row of gorse bushes. It might have been a bit rude to bring someone without being asked.
Oh yes, London etiquette.
I didn't know what she meant. "That's one of the many reasons we left, you know. We just couldn't do with all the pretense. Everyone was so fake in London. Here it's impossible to be fake. There's no one to be fake to. Do you like it here?"
"Of course I do, I love it. I can live the life I've always wanted to live. I get up in the morning and I paint. I'm creative every day. I'm doing what I love. It can be tricky at times, but life's tricky really, isn't it?"
"I suppose so." I couldn't imagine how life could be tricky for the two of them. They did nothing. They taught at the community college a couple of times a week, painted and sat idly in their library. Their biggest worry was running out of books to read. Michael talks of moving back. I think it's difficult for him with his family to do what he's doing. He represents the meritocracy, really. He's worked so hard to get where he is creatively. I appreciate him every day. More cryptic words. I stared at the wine-dark sea, the waves pushing in a sine curve towards the black waters beneath us. The sheer edge of the cliff just a few steps away. Wind buffeting us, grey and granite clouds twisting above. This romantic landscape was what Rose and Michael had wanted then. Give up the rat race in London, not that either of them were ever on it, and go and try to be a modern Wordsworth. "I don't know how you do it, you know. I know it's not quite as bad for you. You teach. You're not quite sitting in an office, but really it's dire, isn't it? All those people sitting in offices, not creating, doing the same thing day in, day out. For what? They're not contributing. They're not really part of society. They're so empty." I wanted to tell her that they might be empty, but so was she. She and Michael engaged in a form of creative masturbation every day, indulging themselves, creating works of art that, after all, helped nobody but themselves and contributed nothing to society or the world, and were even a little dull. Instead, I grunted a response, and she was quiet for a while as we approached a headland. "I don't like to go much further. We'll reach the nearby village soon. I like to stay as isolated as possible." Abruptly, she turned round and we headed back off in the direction of the house. Light filtered through broken clouds, a break in the grey monotony. By the time we reached the house, the sky had turned black and a patter of rain was falling on our coats. We all had lunch, sandwiches with cheap ham, semi-rotten eggs and year-old mayonnaise, and then the two artists said that they needed to spend some time in the afternoon in their studios. They were sorry they had guests, but art must always come first. I was to help myself to anything I wanted in the house and make myself at home. I spent a dull hour reading the newspaper and staring at the rain. Relentless streaks smashed into the kitchen window, menacing, bawdy and monotonous. I wondered how many days of rains they got here. It was probably good for their artistic temperaments. They had not always been so dedicated to their work. When they first started seeing each other, just after my ribald fantasy ended with Rose, they rarely spent any time working on their art at all.
Rose was a teacher and Michael worked freelance for a graphic design company. They got together at some party and been gossiped about for a couple of weeks until the novelty wore off. I never got along with Michael in the early days of their relationship. He was too sensible, too well-meaning, eager with a certain falsity to him. Perhaps now he'd relaxed. There was nothing to do in this grey house but be sensible anyway. Rose was full of guilt. Guilt at I don't know what, but guilty all the same. Ashamed of her achievements, perhaps. In all, they were very dull, wandering around with an existential angst that no one really cared about. And then they announced they were leaving and this was the life they'd run away to. A book of Gustav Klimt's drawings lay open on the coffee table, in the living room, and I entertained myself by flicking through it on their rotting sofa. The house had cold in its walls. A draught, which was practically a wind, rushed through the window. Water seeped through one of the corners of the room, spreading out in a large patch of damp. How could anyone live in a place like this, even if you were creating art? Even if you are supposedly following your dreams? It was damp, cold, dull, with little to do, no inspiration. I imagined them both in their studios, secretly creating, secretly thinking they were above everyone else. They'd always looked on me that way. Yes, they always had, especially Rose, because I did things I didn't necessarily want to do. Somehow, I was beneath them. Because I worked for money, because I didn't pretend to be an artist. I lived an unenlightened life in their eyes. I was tedious, all too tedious. Michael emerged hours later when the sun was already dripping off on the horizon. Sorry, he said. You know how things are. I've got an exhibition coming up in 6 months or so, and I've got to get ready for it. Drink? He poured himself a large whiskey, did the same for me. Rose came into the room, bleary-eyed, somewhat vacant, as if all the creativity had just sucked her soul out. It was a hideous pretense. Mikey, are you cooking again tonight? Am I, he said, mouth half in his glass. We did talk about this. We did? Yes. But I was going to talk to Alistair about his logic. I read something fascinating the other day. Have you heard of Augustus de Morgan? I think... But he was cut off by Rose's stare, and sheepishly, he left to go and prepare our supper. Once again, I was faced with Rose. She perched on the armchair, having helped herself to some wine and smiled at me. I was bored with her already. This woman I'd once thought I'd loved in my own hopeless way, and now she was boring me. I even wrote poetry for her, something about Mozart's mistress. It was helplessly terrible. I thought of Comte and his madness at love and accepted that sometimes even the logical positivists among us go mad with limerence. I'm doing a series on stonemasons. I have to drag my easel and stool out to this quarry in the middle of nowhere on Monday morning. I'll probably get drenched. I have this plastic sheet I put over my easel and try to draw with. It's quite sad, really, but one must make sacrifices. I wondered if she wanted me to be impressed. And what exactly were the sacrifices she'd made? Living off her parents, taking advantage of a house in Ireland that had been in her family for years, living out the fantasy of being a mediocre artist. I suppose I'll have to have an exhibition soon. I don't want to. It's always so dull listening to other people talk about your work. I'd rather just stay here and paint all day, every day, and never see anyone but Michael. She laughed. Who still bought her drawings and paintings? I remembered her first exhibition in London at some trendy gallery that doubled as a warehouse in East London. All her friends had come and bought all her work. She was such a nice girl, after all, with so many friends, that it only made sense all of her friends in full-time employment should buy her work. Slowly, as the exhibitions went on, the friends stopped being so willing to part with their money, and Rose stopped having such success selling her paintings. I suppose, sitting looking into her fading blue eyes, that's what all artists have to do. Sell to their friends and hope someone other than their friends grows interested. At supper, talk continued of art and artists and their superiority to everyone else. I was telling Alistair earlier that we're really very lucky, aren't we? We don't have to go and sit in an office and stare at the wall. It feels like those people really are wasting their lives, doesn't it? But some of them have to go to work, darling. It's not like they want to be there. But you always have a choice. My mother taught me you always have a choice. It seemed her mother had taught her a hell of a cliché. Yes, but money is the difference. Growing up, my family didn't have much money, and we appreciated that freedom has as much to do with money as it does to do with anything else. I wasn't convinced by this claim. Michael had always struck me as the sort of person who claims to have no money but actually does. Perhaps lying and saying his family were poor was an excellent way of coming up with an origin story. Every artist needs a tale of hardship and poverty, after all. You can't be Van Gogh without at least pretending to have suffered. I wish they could all just open their eyes, realise that they don't have to go to work and be drones, that they can be creative. A nice bit of liberal politics, just to remind the two of us, who didn't need to be reminded that she was in touch with the liberal bourgeois. And being creative. Yes, creative. That's all that mattered. Paintbrush, an easel, canvas, palette. Creative. But they probably have families to look after. Yes, but they're so blind. They're not blind. They just have to work to live. Why do you have to do this every time we have one of these conversations? Every time you shoot me down. You know as well as I do that these people are slaves. I'm not shooting you down. We've had this conversation before. Just because you work in an office does not make you a mindless drone. But it does. You've never worked in an office, so how would you know? Well said, I thought. Rose was silenced by this, and we all focused on eating the kidneys Michael had so selflessly prepared for us. A couple of sips of wine and Rose began again. Just because I've never worked in an office doesn't mean I don't understand their mentality. Michael ignored her. A recent habit I've acquired is witnessing the gradual breakdown of my friends' relationships. I don't know why, but I've been present when three couples have had their final argument. It's like I don't exist, like I'm part of the decor. And they can scream and wail and hate each other in front of me. Very strange, really. I imagine that because they know I'm a logician, they think I'm slightly autistic and therefore can be ignored like a child. It always makes for entertaining viewing. I don't want to talk about it anymore, muttered Michael, focusing on his string beans. Another sip of wine from Rose, and another straight after it. Why not just chug the whole glass? That's what you want to do. Let it all out, get smashed, and maybe smash a glass or two. A plate, maybe. Well, I do. I want to talk about it. It's important to me. I want to know why you're defending them. It's disloyal. It's not disloyal. I'm not defending them. You just have to see that they're not all mindless drones. You know, I don't have to let you live here. You know, this is my house. Mine. All the good work you do wouldn't be possible without me. I refuse to have this conversation with you. Why? Because I'm right. That's why. Fine. Yes. You're right. The conversation had become rather dull and I hoped it was over. I wondered if they categorised me as one of those worker drones. While I was not in an office per se, I did spend some time in an office when duty required me to. And what did they think of scientists like me? What did they think of logicians, mathematicians? Were they all mindless drones too? What do you think of academics, I ventured, not content to let this insightful conversation just end. Depends what they're academics in. Well, smiling, what do you think of logicians, for example? Michael took control of answering. Rose was looking sullenly and sulkily at her glass of wine. I poured her another one. There's nothing wrong with logicians, but they're a bit like mathematicians, in the sense that they don't really add much to society. It's all just mental masturbation, really. Almost like an ivory tower of academia. There's no practical application to the work they do. Much like artists, I suppose. At this, they both perked up, looked like rabbits near a gun shop, ears pricked, noses and whiskers twitching, mouths pursed in shocked outrage. Well? Well? Artists offer people hope. Hope. Exactly. Artists are like the guardians in the darkness. We give people something to cling to, something to believe in. Believe in. Exactly. Art is all that's left to stop the horrible assault on our senses, on our whole culture. Assault. Precisely. Well put, darling. It sounded rehearsed, and Rose was positively simmering after her little enlightenment. What about mediocre art? And this question was somehow not heard, despite the silence in the kitchen, because they both were mediocre artists, in much the same way that I was a mediocre logician worthy only of teaching undergraduates. They were mediocre artists, worthy only of teaching a couple of classes a week to the recently divorced. Most writers and artists, I thought, have never done anything with their lives. Most of them sit in their studios hammering away at the same thing, again and again and again, thinking they're being profound. But what was better, to go and be a busybody office bee, or run away and become an artist? To be a talentless bore trying to be profound or a dull, dronish office worker? Was this all there was? Was everybody so monke? It seemed so. I agree, though, I said. My profession is completely useless. They both nodded approval over their wine. The rest of the evening was spent dully. Michael again had to retire to his studio, and Rose followed soon after. Rather than sitting alone in my room, I sat alone in the living room, watching the rain fall in lines bent by the wind to the sea. It was nice to be out of London, at least. This was a peaceful spot. I went to bed drunk. There was no one to watch the drinks cabinet, so I happily drank 4 whiskey tumblers without being told off. I think I heard another argument in the night, but drunkenness and semi-hallucinatory sleep meant I could have perceived them having sex as arguing, or the other way round. Rose was sprightly in the morning. "Good morning," she said to me as I emerged, hungover, eyes crusted with sleepy dust. "And what a wonderful morning it is. What time's your train?" "At 12. Would you mind terribly if we left you in town at 10-ish? Only we're going in and need to get back to continue working." "Not at all." "It's quite a journey back. What time's your flight from Dublin?" "It is. 6 o'clock, I think." "Well, thanks so much for coming to see us. It's nice to see old friends after so long." After a brief, silent breakfast, they drove me to town and dropped me off, while they returned to their little world of art and solitude, and the rain and the sea, and a hapless ignorance of everything but their own vapid creations. How long could their deluded fantasy go on? Another 10 years? Would they ever reach a state of penury that required them to get real jobs? Sadly not. Sadly, they'd bumble away as unknown artists for the rest of their lives, and I'd be happy teaching logic to surly, dull undergraduates.
Other People's Flowers was produced by Hugo Gibson, Chris Kamonvutitam, and Hamish Adam Cairns. If you'd like to have your work featured on the show, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. Thank you for listening.